FreeSky is a manufacturer of radio control transmitters, receivers, and electronics that became very popular years ago among the FPV drone community, and during the past couple of years has been taking over a larger percentage of the airplane market worldwide. Today, I'm talking to Steve Schlesinger, more commonly known as FreeSky Steve. He's the fixed wing segment manager for FreeSky and one of the most prominent faces for the company in the US. In our chat, Steve gives us some juicy details about the just announced X20 RS transmitter. He also explains how the tandem protocol works, what it could save your plane, how you should position your antennas and perform range checks to maximize the reliability of your transmissions. We also chat about the latest firmware updates FreeSky has been working on and what's next for the company in the future. Hey Steve, how are you doing?
Doing fantastic. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being with us in the Skybound RC podcast.
I want to say that you have like a lot of really great guests in the past, and I want to be here to help bring down the quality of the show. So thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
I'm sure it will be great. So let's see. I met you last year, probably around September or so, and I've been talking to you a lot since I switched to FreeSky and I joined the team. But for those people that might not be as familiar with you, can you maybe give it a background about who you are, what your role is with FreeSky, that kind of stuff?
My name is Steve. I am with FreeSky. I've been with FreeSky for going on 2 years in June. And essentially, I am the fixed wing segment manager. So what I do is I'm at the interface between the fixed wing community and FreeSky. So I represent FreeSky to the fixed wing community and the fixed wing community to FreeSky. And so that's kind of a heavy role to have. But we are definitely getting a lot closer to the end user, especially with the fixed wing community. And essentially my main task is to go around and I travel quite a bit. I try to get out to people, to the end users, go to shows, go to flying events and try to, you know, get the radios into hands of people and answer questions as they come up.
So I know that a lot of people, when they hear FreeSky, the first thing they think of is drones. And I think that's because FreeSky was a very big player for a long time in the world of drones. But it seems like that kind of mindset in terms of the products that FreeSky is releasing, in terms of their target customer base, has been changing over time. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about the general story of FreeSky in the past couple of years and how the company has been kind of switching gears and changing their focus.
Okay, so FreeSky has been around since 2010, so we're about a 14-year-old company right now. And what happened was FreeSky started off as just a fixed-wing community radio transmitter. It was before even transmitters. What we had was a module that went in the back of other radios, and we had receivers. And what we had was something that worked exceptionally well, and people really loved it. And then around 2013, we came out with we bought the mold from JR from one of their beloved radios, and we came out with the X9D, and that was our first real radio. And that when that came out, we came out with a one of the things that it had with it, with our entire setup, was S-Bus. And around that time, the drone community really started to take off. And the reason why we were a perfect fit for them was they needed lots of channels, more than 8 channels. We were on to 16 channels at this point. And they needed lots of switches because they need to do a lot of different things with the drones. So because we had S-Bus, and because we had 16 channels, and because we were so affordable, we were a perfect fit. And so kind of in this period of time, I would say it was around 2014, 2015 to about 2019. So it was a good 5-year period. It was about the time that the whole drone industry was growing by leaps and bounds. And you kind of remember that as you're driving down the street in your town, you probably saw a drone store every 5 miles. Around after 2019, I don't know, a lot of the drone the hobby kind of just, drones are still popular, but it's changed. You know, now they're more like DJI drones. So there are still race quads, but unfortunately all those drone stores are now, vape stores, and the drone community is still fairly strong. But the reality is that, you know, we hit the peak when it was, I think it was like the perfect timing. We were there right as things were taking off and we rode the wave. But realistically, it's not like we discovered fixed wing. We were essentially fixed wing all along. And so what we did was we started going back and thinking about things, about how, where we came from and what we needed to do in order to go further. And one of the things we looked at was our operating system, OpenTX. And I know we're going to get into this a little bit later, but essentially, it was not a perfect thing for the fixed wing community. It was just too complex. The drone pilots could figure it out because they don't really need to do a lot of tinkering with the radios at the field. But fixed wing pilots, we need to do stuff at the field. So I know we are associated with drones, but that essentially, it's not like Free Sky was like, oh gosh, we just found fixed wing once again. No, it was, we were always in the fixed wing market. We always had offerings to the fixed wing market. It just got overshadowed by the drone market.
Is that still the case today? What's the current approximate split in terms of drones versus fixed wing versus helicopters versus, I don't know if Free Sky does anything with ground today?
All right, so what happens now is, I would say, drones are, you know, it used to be like 90% of what we did, and everything else was 10% of what we did. I don't know what the exact numbers are, but it seems to me that fixed wing is probably about 60% of what we do, and drones are probably somewhere in the 30% of what we do, and there's another 10% of other things, is the best way to describe it.
So I want to get into a lot of the details about Free Sky ecosystem in general, but I know there's something pretty exciting to talk about, which is a new radio that was just announced, right? Can you talk about this one?
Yes. So it is coming out, as you're seeing this, it's coming out, it's introduced today. There's a trade show in mainland China, and it's being rolled out. It's called the X20RS. And so a lot of questions about this one. And so I can kind of make it simple for people to understand. What this is an X20 Pro in a plastic shell. However, it's not the X20S in a, you know, the shell is different. So we went in and we bought a new mold. And we listened to people because a lot of the feedback was the radio is a little too short. And because it's a little too short, they really would like to have like an extra inch or two. And I've had more people say, man, I've had that extra inch or two. This thing would be just perfect. This would be the best radio ever. And so,
and to give people a reference or a bit more context, I think right now Free Sky has a big range of transmitters. But from what I can tell on the fixed wing side of things, there's two really big sellers, right? The most popular ones I see in the fields are the X20S. That's the one I use right now, the X20S Red. And then there's the X20 Pro, right? And the general shape is fairly similar. The X20 Pro is more expensive. It has like a metal front face, right? It has additional trims. And then it seems like this new one sits kind of in between with an additional change on the shape.
Right. So essentially what happens is Free Sky is going to have a complete line. It's going to start off with the X14, which is an inexpensive, this is under $200 transmitter that does 24 channels, that does Ethos, that has the module in the back so it can work with the multi-protocol module. We're also, that's a twin protocol though. Then you get into the next one after that is the twin X-Lite S, and that is what looks like the game style controller. All these run Ethos, by the way. And then after that, you get into the X18, which is one of the radios that was originally, it was the X20 and the X18 with the two primary radios. And the X20 was just one of those radios that people just, the X20S in particular, people just picked up and loved. And the X20 Pro was something we came out with because the guys who fly turbine jets really wanted to have a little something extra. They wanted to have a few extra features that just weren't on the S. So we put that in there. And we also put in this protocol, three different bands, because there's essentially two bands, 2.4 gigahertz and 900 megahertz. But there are two long-range transmit modules. One of them is a 2.4 gigahertz LoRa, which stands for long range, and the other one's 900 megahertz. And then the last one is the 2.4 gigahertz FSK, which is equivalent to like the Futabas and the Spectrums of the world. So those three bands means, or three different transmit modules mean that it will work with both the tandem and also the twin receivers. So the thing is that when we came to market with this, we came to the market with a premium radio. People thought we couldn't do it. It was a really interesting thing as this thing, the X20 Pro, came out, because from the moment that we had a conversation with Mike Lynn in Irvine to the moment I held it in my hands was essentially 10 months.
That's pretty quick.
Essentially, after the X20 Pro came out, what we started to hear was, unfortunately, when you think about what's happening in the world right now, their economy is not doing great in the United States, but it's doing horribly in Europe. And because of that, people came to us and said, man, I really would like to buy that X20 Pro, but geez, I cannot come up with $1,000 US to buy this radio. I would really like it if you can have something for sale in the $500 to $600 range. And that was one of the reasons why we looked at the X20 RS. So the RS is going to have the text-to-speech. It's going to have some really nice sliders on it. And it's going to have not four trims, but actually six. So you're going to have a T5 and T6. And that's great for doing some fine tuning. And it's going to have 8 gigabytes of high-speed internal memory. And that's the one thing I really would like to kind of emphasize, is that people will try to put, when they had SD cards, they would try to put 64 gigabytes of whatever in there. 4 gigabytes of internal memory is just a memory for a SD card is something that's really difficult to fill up. 8 gigabytes is twice as much of that. So, I mean, 8 gigabytes should be plenty for just about all the applications, unless you're putting full albums and music on there to listen to.
Yeah, for the most part, the only thing you have there is a couple of very small pictures of your models. And if you are storing logs of your flights, you have to do a lot of flights and log a lot of data to start filling it up.
I don't think you can possibly fill it up. It's because those files are all 3K, 8K, 10K, maybe 20K. And so when you're talking gigabytes, it's going to take a very long time to fill that up. So I believe it will take a micro SD card as well. You will not need it. In fact, it's kind of a detriment to put one in. It's just the internal memory is so much faster. This is the one thing that I really think was really missing with the X20S. And I love the X20S. I have two of these radios. The X20S uses the micro SD cards. And after a while, they can get a little bit funky. And sometimes people had problems with that. And it's a bit of a bummer when you're out somewhere and your micro SD card starts working up. But this is something that doesn't really happen with this internal memory. So what we saw was that the X18 had the internal memory. It had the T5 and T6 trim. All right, so for the T5 and T6 on the X18, it was not on the X20. And because of that, it was always something that when people sit there and looked at the two radios and compared and contrast them, they were like, man, I like this bigger screen on the X20S. but I really like this T5 and T6 on trims on this X18 radio. I kind of would like to have both. And so the X20 was our first tandem radio. It really is the one that needed the most updating. And so it's coming out now updated with the X20 RS. It's going to be the X20R and the X20RS. The thing that is the million-dollar question is what happens to the X20S? And the short answer is we don't know. I mean, it essentially, my gut feeling is that the X20 is going to disappear. I think the X20S in black is going to disappear because it's not a huge seller. And there might just be the X20S red that sticks around and the blue is, if I were to put money on it, these are the things that will stick around long term. And then the next thing people are going to ask is it worth upgrading? Like a guy like myself, I have two of the X20Ss. Do I need to go out and buy an X20RS? And, you know, I fly mainly tandem. I don't really have a lot of need for the twin receivers. So, or I'll fly Archer, or sometimes the old ACCST X8R receivers. So the reality is, it's going to come down to a touch and feel type of situation. How it feels in your hands, how it looks, and that's the thing that I can't tell at this moment. I mean, I saw the photos of this radio briefly. It does look like a cool radio. I will give it that. It's going to come out in black. It's going to come out in red. But essentially what it's going to be is people are going to have to put their hands on it. And then it's going to be one of those things. It's either, yeah, this thing's amazing. And I told, you know, management, it's going to go one of two ways. Either people are going to say, this is the most amazing thing ever. Or they're going to say, I'm really happy with my X20S. It does everything I need. But this is a nice option. And if I had to get another radio, I'll buy this. But for the meantime, I'm sticking with the X20S.
Yeah, it seems like for most part, I imagine that will come down to ergonomics. Does this feel better or worse than the other shape of the X20S? Or if somebody really wants one of those additional features in particular, right? Like the additional two trimmers, I can see that being useful for things like thrust vector airplanes. That gives you additional trimming capabilities that you can get away without, but it's much nicer to have that available there. And then there's other nice little halves, right? Like the text-to-speech. That's always nice. So I'm excited to get my hands in one of those to at least try it. Do you have an approximate price, an approximate date here in the U.S.?
Yes, for both. So the price for the X20 RS is going to be $650, and then the R is going to be down, so it's going to be somewhere in the $550 to $575 price range, I'd say. And then the release date, so what's happening is we're getting about 20 to 30 of them shipped into the United States right away, so they'll be here. By the time people see this, we'll have them available, and we're going to take some with us to Joe Nall. However, there's a shipment that left a couple weeks ago, and it's on its way. So by the middle of May, we'll have around 50 of each color. So that's a pretty good inventory. And I highly recommend that instead of going and ordering these radios from China directly, slow it down a little bit, order them from your local retailer. So if you have a retailer you work with, anything from A-Loft, A-Main, GetFPV, I'm naming not my accounts, by the way, Gator RC, A&E, I mean, there's just, we have about 30 or 40 different retailers, Banana Hobby, they just keep going on and on. So I'm sure that most people out there have a relationship in North America with one of these dealers. When you're in other parts of the world, because I'm sure this is being watched in other places, there are some very big dealers that have them as well. T9 in Germany, I believe it is, or it might be in the UK. no, that's UK. There's another Ingle something in Germany. So these are the big Free Sky retailers in these countries. I would absolutely suggest that you deal with these people directly.
Cool. Excited to take a look at this. So you mentioned before a little bit about the Tandem protocol and the 2.4 and 9 megahertz, the dual band that a lot of these radios, all of the radios that we just talked about have. Can you talk a bit about why that's important? Because for the most part, most transmitter brands, you know, Spectrum, Futaba, Powerbox, they are running just 2.4, right? What's so significant about having 2.4 plus 900 for RC planes?
Okay, so essentially, I've been following the history of RC. For many, many years, it was in the United States, it was 72 megahertz, was like the big radio transmit band. And what happened with that, it was a nightmare, because what would happen is you're out flying your plane and you have your little flag up there and you're on channel 38, and then someone else wants to check their servos out or check the, and then they turn on channel 38 and your plane crashes. So when 2.4 gigahertz came out, it was like, everyone, let's have a big party. We no longer need these flags. This is the most amazing frequency they could ever imagine. This thing has, it's so big, it's so vast. We can have 300, 400 people flying at the same time, and they don't have to worry about stepping over each other. So 2.4 gigahertz FSK was absolutely stellar, amazing. And that was around, as I call it, the turn of the century, around 2005 that came out, I would say. But what's happened since that time is, we started to have some issues, and that is the amount of noise. There's so much of this out there, the 2.4 gigahertz, that there's issues with it. And then the issues is that there's, I call it 2.4 gigahertz pollution. And then other things started creeping up as well, which is, we're flying in sometimes very remote places, but we have infrastructure around it. So it could be something industrial, like an oil well, or it could be something like turning on water for cattle, or sometimes these were light controllers for local highways. Whatever it is, what happens is a lot of times what they do is they broadcast in a very narrow beam. And that narrow beam is usually, I found this local, in one of the places I fly at, they have telephone poles, they have transformers on them. So they would have one transformer every half hour or so broadcast a signal over to another transformer, which had the Ethernet connection on there, so they can get it back to the main, you know, power company, and they can see how much power is being consumed in real time. The problem was that this beam, it's a very narrow beam that they broadcast, but sometimes they go over the legal limit, and sometimes it's just because it's a narrow band. If you happen to fly through that, your plane goes down. And we've seen this time and time again. And there's just been a lot of fields lately where these things are showing up in industrial, for one reason or another. There's something out there in the field that's taking planes down. And because of that, people started looking for alternatives. And the alternatives was 900 megahertz. 900 megahertz is a shorter wave band. And the idea behind this is that it can actually travel around. It goes further and it penetrates better. So it goes around trees and sometimes to some extent buildings. So the idea is that it gave a very strong way of making sure that it's the best, most secure link there is. The problem with 900 megahertz is that the band is not as large as 2.4 gigahertz. You can't have 300 people on it. So most flying fields at, you know, one time, you're flying, you know, 5-6 pilots at a time. Not really a big issue. So the what happens with Tandem is we start off when you're flying around, and I look at the log files for most of the flights I see coming in. It's 2.4 gigahertz, I say, works about 99% of the time. The problem with 2.4 gigahertz is, and they always say that there's a killer part of the field. It's usually when you're coming in for a landing. It's when your plane is coming in and it's turning, and the 2.4 gigahertz likes being on the same plane as the transmitter. When the plane changes, when the plane essentially turns, what ends up happening is you end up having what the receiver pointing the antennas to the sky and the ground. So it's not in the same plane. And years ago, Spectrum figured this out. And what they did is they told people, put a satellite receiver in a different orientation and that will take care of that. And that does work sometimes, most of the time. But there are times that for one reason or another, the 2.4 gigahertz goes away. And that oftentimes is only for a very short period of time. When I look in the telemetry logs, it might only be out for a couple seconds, 2 or 3 seconds. But when it goes out, pretty much it's one of those, it's a difference between taking your plane home and putting it away safely and or taking your plane home in a trash bag.
Yeah, even a single second of like data loss there can be pretty catastrophic with an airplane.
Yeah, so data loss. The idea is that FreeSky, what we use is both the 2.4 gigahertz and 900 megahertz receivers are in the same receiver box, so to speak, it's in the same package. And because it's in there, you don't have to have any fancy wiring between the two receivers, setting up SBUS or whatever else. It's a one simple plug-and-play solution, and it works brilliantly.
Yep. So you have these tandem systems, both in the transmitter and the tandem receivers that are that they usually come with like at least one 2.4 and one 900 megahertz antenna on both. Sometimes you have like two 2.4 antennas, right? And it's all part of the same packets. The other company that is leveraging 900 megahertz to increase or improve reliability is Yeti. Can you talk about what's different between the way Yeti uses 900 megahertz versus the way FreeSky Tandem does?
So Yeti, I consider Yeti to be probably one of our best competitors, and they've been around since, I believe, the 1990s. So it's a very good company. They make good quality products, nice heavy radios. I like their stuff. When it comes to how their protocols work, they're completely different. What they do is they use two 2.4 gigahertz receivers. So it's the same kind of redundancy you would find in Spectrum, one of the satellite receivers. So hopefully if one doesn't work, the other one will work. If it goes into failsafe, and that's a big if, which means that neither of them are receiving, then what will happen is it will go to 900 megahertz if you have a 900 megahertz receiver there. When you go to 900 megahertz, you'll absolutely know it because it will feel different. The plane will resolution won't be as sharp as it was on 2.4 gigahertz. This is what I've been told. And it's something that's noticeable. And sometimes it's only for a few seconds, like I mentioned before, but a few seconds will save you. So this was kind of like the way things were done for many, many years. What happens with FreeSky, ours is a little bit different because what happens is both receivers are working simultaneously. We work with something called VFR, for valid frame rates. So what happens is when one receiver, the 2.4 gigahertz, when it starts, a frame is, there's 2 to 3 frames in a packet. So you heard a packet's a data. What happens is it keeps track of the number of frames it sends out. So about every 100 frames or so, there'll be like a little reseed in there saying, I sent you 100 frames. What did you get? And it will report back. I received back 90 frames out of those 100. Okay, so you have a 90% success rate. And your plane can keep flying until, we don't really worry about it until it gets in below 40s. So the first one that's going to go away is 2.4 gigahertz. That's the valid frame rates are going to drop. And then instead of waiting for it to go all the way into failsafe, what will happen is the receiver will decide that this 2.4 gigahertz signal is degrading. However, 900 megahertz is still strong. So I'm going to fill in the missing packets or missing frames with 2.4 with 900 megahertz. And because it does it that way, you can't tell the difference. The only way we could tell the difference was you would get a low VFR warning. And for about a year and a half, I'd say about 8 months ago, we changed this. We used to have it turned on so that when you got to a point where your valid frame rates on 2.4 gigahertz drop below a certain level, it will announce, hey, low VFR warning. But that freaked the people the hell out. I mean, I had people calling me at Sundays screaming at me like, is this thing about to crash my plane? You know, and like, we'd look at the telemetry logs and like, no, you were nowhere near close to crashing. So what I finally was able to do is convince management to get the engineers to get rid of that. We don't want to get a 2.4 gigahertz low VFR warning. If you get a low VFR warning, it means both you've exhausted 2.4 gigahertz and your 900 megahertz is getting, or yeah, 900 megahertz valid frame rates are getting low. So you really should turn the plane around. And if you're getting that, it's usually an issue with the placement of your antennas, or perhaps you should turn up your milliwatts on your 900 megahertz, and that's in the RF section of the transmitter in Ethos.
So if I understand correctly, it sounds like with FreeSky Tandem, you are prioritizing 2.4. Once the 2.4 signal degrades enough, you start bringing in packets from the 900, and then you end up using both simultaneously until 2.4 gets back into a good state, and then you just use 2.4 only. Versus with Yeti, you are only using 2.4, and once the signal goes like extremely bad, or you basically lose it, is when it flips over to 900.
Essentially, it has to give up, and then it will say, what other options do I have? If you don't have the 900 megahertz receiver with Yeti, well.
I think it's common enough to see 900 megahertz receivers in Yeti setups for like very expensive planes, like, you know, your like $15,000 jets. When people have smaller planes, a bit less common, because like adding complexity, adding cost. So that's definitely something nice. I think for me, pretty much anything that is not like a tiny electric plane, I use Tandem receiver because the price is so relatively cheap, and it's a lot of peace of mind to have there, like the 900 in addition to the 2.4.
The one thing I will say though about 900 megahertz, I mean, I know it's great to put these in planes that are turbine jets, and yes, we do have these receivers flying in $30,000 turbine jets, but it's not really a price thing for a lot of people. It's kind of I spent my time working on this, and maybe you have a, I don't know, $500 plane, $300 plane, but you spent the winter working on it and you have hours and hours into it, and it really sucks to bring that thing home in a trash bag. So the idea is that these things are affordable. I mean, our least expensive Tandem receiver is $40. So it's very affordable. That's for a 6-channel. And, you know, this is something, if you have something nice, like the Viper Jet from eFlight is $650. It'd be perfect for that. Or if you can afford it, I would say an even better solution for the Viper Jet would be the TDSR10, because it's a 10-channel receiver and it's stabilized. So things like that. And that's about a $90 receiver. And so, yeah, they're affordable. But the thing is that we just want to bring our planes home. We want to enjoy them, have a great time, and bring it back and not have to cry at night.
Yeah, no, there's nothing worse than losing a plane, especially when it's something that is out of your control. Like, you're not even the one making the pilot error. It's just like, you lose connection, and you basically have to see your plane slowly getting close to the ground. You cannot touch. You cannot do anything to have a different outcome.
Yeah, it's interesting because I fly with a bunch of guys on Sunday mornings, and occasionally I hear one scream out, "I don't got it! I don't got it!" And we at one point we grabbed someone's radio and we held it over our head and were able to get the plane back because he flew it so far away they couldn't get reception anymore. So, yeah, those things happen.
You mentioned before something about the antenna placement and receiver placement in the plane. I know this probably depends a lot on the particular setup, how many receivers they're using, what receivers, what size of the plane they're using, what the materials of the plane are, but do you have any general best practices for people using, in this case, FreeSky receivers in terms of receiver antenna placement, orientation, things like that, that people should like watch out for when they are setting up their planes?
I could pretty much explain it for all receivers. So even if they're Spectrum or Futaba or whatever else, there's here, you know, I'm about the hobby, so I'll make sure everyone gets good information. Essentially, what happens is the antennas, and I think I might have one. Oh, I got, look at this. Just to show I'm a guy, I have my Spectrum receiver right here, and you can see that what you have are two antennas. Now, at the end of this, it's hard to see, maybe, if I can bring it close.
And for those only listening, that's a Spectrum receiver with two 2.4 gigahertz antennas.
This is a 2.4 gigahertz Spectrum receiver, right? And this is what looks like fishing wire right here. This is the antenna. The plastic part below it does not transmit, or I'm sorry, does not receive. Same with this one. So the idea is that they should be in an L, and especially the white parts should be in an L to each other. So one should either go straight up to the sky or straight down to the ground, and the other one should run the length of the fuselage. And that's for 2.4 gigahertz. When it comes to 900 megahertz, with our transmitters, the tandem transmitters, I think I might have one right here. Oh, look at this. Just happen to have one sitting here. It's the nice thing about having a messy office. I can have all sorts of cool stuff laying around. So this is the 900 megahertz T antenna. And so occasionally I see people mount it like this. This is a no-no. It has to be horizontal. It could go this way. It can go this way. It can't go this way. It has to run. I tell people, point to both sides of the fuselage. Don't point it to the sky and the ground.
So 2.4 vertical and longitudinal axis of the plane, 900 megahertz, keep it horizontal. Cool. The other thing that I'm guessing is also pretty important when looking at this is doing a proper range check prior to a maiden of a plane, right?
Right. Yeah, you do the range check. And most of the transmitters work the same. Ours, what we do is we essentially cut the power down to about 1/30. I've had someone suggest to me it's more like 1/40 to 1/50 power. And the idea is that what I do is I take it out to as far as way as when I can see things, the signal drop. So I can usually what happens is 2.4 gigahertz gives up first for the FSK. And then the 900 megahertz keeps going. And then when you get to a point where it finally fails, you take a measurement of that, multiply by 30, 40, 50, and sometimes you have miles of coverage is the best way to describe it.
What would be a good distance that people should be aiming for during their range check before they lose that connection to feel good about flying, you know, given that the typical distance that we fly our RC planes?
With this, okay, so it has to be on something that's unobstructed, a field of view, something. I say 2.4 gigahertz is about 150 to 180 feet is where you should ideally be before you start losing range. If you start losing range in less than 100 feet, then there's a problem and you need to look at that. A lot of times what happens is the placement, things like batteries in a plane, sometimes those block the signal. Carbon fiber also blocks the signal. If you're building a glider, for example, and your glider is made out of carbon fiber, you need to put your antennas outside the glider.
The other thing that I see often people wonder about is pricing with FreeSky. I know that for me, that was one of the first things that caught my attention is how affordable Free Sky products in general, and that goes for receivers, for transmitters, distribution boxes. How affordable Free Sky products are when you compare them with pretty much all of the competitors, right? If you look at Spectrum, Yeti, Powerbox, JR, they all have nice products. They're all significantly more expensive. And I know when I was starting to look into Free Sky, the first thing that came to mind is, oh, I guess that these, you know, Free Sky transmitters probably are for beginners. They don't let you do anything particularly advanced. And the funny thing is that tends to be kind of the opposite. I think for the most part, Free Sky is particularly well known for the amount of flexibility, customization. You can do pretty advanced things if you want to. And the system kind of works with you rather than you having to fight the system to do those things. And the other part of it is quality, right? People might think, oh, maybe this is like bad quality product and that's why it's so cheap. I know that, I know that for me, again, like when I actually made the switch to from Spectrum to Free Sky, I had some issues with Spectrum, and that was at the time where I was starting to get into turbine jets, which is like a very, very expensive type of airplane that you definitely don't want to have any type of problem with reception. And I honestly didn't care about the cost of the transmitter. I just wanted to have the most peace of mind knowing that I was using the best possible system that would decrease the options or the chances of having a link drop and crash a $10,000-$15,000 airplane, right? But I'm sure that I'm not the only one that had those initial thoughts when seeing the pricing of Free Sky. So I wonder, you know, you talk to a lot of customers or potential customers, you talk about this type of stuff a lot. So I'm kind of curious to hear people's perception on pricing and you being part of Free Sky, to hear your thoughts about how Free Sky approaches pricing, quality of their products in a market that typical price is a bit higher or significantly higher than what Free Sky products tend to sell for.
I'll address quality first of all, because that's the easiest one for me to handle. A couple years ago, I was at a flying event, and I met Dirk from Pacific Jets. And I sat there, and I started giving the sales pitch about Free Sky. And I went, yada, 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 right? And Dirk said, okay, great, okay. And he said, here's a guy you could send. He's one of our main guys in the company. You could send him a radio. And he'll review it. And if he likes it, we'll carry it. So what I didn't know was when I sent the radio to this guy, Jeff, in the South, and he ended up giving it to somebody else, and the guy disassembled the radio and took it and put it under a microscope. What he does is he evaluates quality control for the, I would say, military and aerospace. And so they took a look at the radio in a way that most people don't have the ability to look at the radio. And they were beyond impressed. And the thing was, what they told me is, I said, like you were mentioning before, turbine jets, these things are $30,000. If this thing is chintzy and cheap, we don't have time for it. I mean, Dirk is just that kind of guy. No, hell no. And 5 years from now, it will still be hell no. This was my one shot. And it was just one of our random radios that we sent to him. And, you know, the quality is exceptional. Now, what happened, the quality price thing, how this all got started, was the people who started the company, the owners, it's still the same people. They are engineers. They're not salespeople. So they did not think about marketing or anything else. All they did is they came out with a module and receivers, and they started selling these things. And everything was kind of like, well, I could sell it for this much and still make money. So it was always, especially when dealing with things out of China, it always starts off inexpensive. And the reason why is because if we were, you know, trying to get Futaba money, Futaba was the big brand at the time, for our receivers and transmit modules, it would have been a harder acceptance. So after that, I mentioned the drones, how the drone grew, and it was us and Futaba, and we were the cheaper alternative, and we got the lion's share of the market with the drones. But the difference was is that it was never, quality was never really something that we ever took second place. And it was always something that they've always worried about. We have to make sure we have the best quality products. And, I mean, working with FreeSky, there was a time when we had a bad batch of TDR-10s. And this was around March of last year. And I knew when this came out because there were probably like 10 receivers. And I found all 10 of the people. They contacted me like we had a problem with these receivers. And I could tell kind of like when they came out. The quality, it was some of these, for whatever reason, they didn't do such a great job of soldering the receivers, and some of the ends weren't exactly perfect. And then it was a quality control issue that went on for maybe, I would say it was probably a couple days before it was caught. But we haven't had that issue ever since then. I mean, the quality control issues that we have, we get back very few products, I would say, that are faulty that we have to replace. So it is, the quality is exceptional. And the thing that I tell management all the time is I say, I know these people, I know them really well. Not only do I know them, they all have my cell phone number. So with their problems, I hear about it. And when I hear about it, you're going to hear about it. So the thing is that we can charge an extra $10 a receiver and people will pay it. What we can't afford is to have people lose their planes. So absolutely reinforce 1,000% quality has to be superb. The price thing is because prices were based off of selling radios to kids who are flying drones. And a lot of time, this was their birthday money and their bar mitzvah money. And they didn't really have the money to pay for the stuff. So it was always kind of like, that's where it came from. And coming into the plane market where, yes, all of a sudden you have a transmitter that does more at $500 than our competitors do at $2,000, gives you an opportunity. On one hand, you can sit there and say, huh, this actually came down to the X20 Pro. It was the original plan on the X20 Pro, before they figured out how much it actually cost to make this thing, was to sell it for $600. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. And I said, listen, and I've told management this. I said, in my long career in sales, I've never gone to management and say, you're charging too little for something. But then they realized that, yeah, these radios do cost quite a bit more to manufacture than they thought. So the prices that they are realistic. But what the initial thought was when it was still kind of being figured out was like, yeah, this would be about a $600 radio. So they're really uncomfortable with those prices. On the other hand, what I've kind of noticed also is that a lot of these guys who are flying turbine jets, a lot of them who fly with those expensive radios that you mentioned before, a lot of these radios are purchased around prior to the pandemic. And when you're getting a 10 to 15% return on your portfolio, putting aside $3,000 to $5,000 on a new radio system is not a big deal. Spending an extra $2,000 a year on receivers is not a big deal when you're spending $60,000 a year on your jets. We're kind of a different world now, post-pandemic, and all of a sudden, as I mentioned before, there's issues in Europe with affordability. We're just kind of in this world now where things kind of have to make sense. And what I've kind of noticed was the reception I got at the flying field, like the first, I'd say, 6 months, people would walk by where I had my stuff set up, and they would walk by and they kind of like give me the look like, oh, there's that cheap Chinese stuff again. And then after about 6 months, they would walk up to me and say, listen, I'm never going to buy your radios, but my friends like your radio, and I want to look at them. And I knew that was something, but when we came out with the X20 Pro, all of a sudden I saw those people who would never buy a radio with the X20 Pro, because it's just really a fantastic radio. So that's kind of where we're looking at as far as FreeSky. What I'm trying to help them out with is that you don't have to have the low price solution. You have to have the best solution. And the best solution might be a little bit more money. It's okay. We can get, people will pay more for it if they perceive the quality is there.
Yeah. So definitely the quality, the price point, the flexibility, FreeSky are all big selling points. I imagine that one of the typical issues that you might encounter when you're talking to people thinking or considering switching to FreeSky is that fear of switching to a new system, right? Regardless of a FreeSky or something else, switching transmitter brands comes with some friction, with some additional homework for the new pilot that is grabbing the new transmitter and needs to learn how to program their new plane. How has your experience been bringing new people into FreeSky? Do people get into it pretty easily, pretty quickly? Do people struggle with certain parts of the system? How does it usually go?
I think the thing that's scared me the most, we have a field rep in Texas, 14 years old, and he got the radio. He figured it out in approximately 45 minutes. He had pretty well figured it out. He could do what he needed to do, the basics, and he kept going from there. So some people adapt to these radios amazingly fast, or, you know, I think you were one of the guys who picked it up fairly quickly because you had experiences with other brands before, right? You had Spectrum, and before that, what else did you have?
Many years ago, like my first couple of radios were Futabas. I had the Wetronic when that was a thing, Grubner, most recently a Spectrum.
Right. So I think Futaba is great for us because that's a pretty difficult radio system to figure out. But it does train you to think about radios in a way that if you can figure out a Futaba radio, then our radios are extremely easy to figure out. And it's because all the information with all these brands are all in there. So they all do dual rates, they all do expo, they all do some kind of mixing. It's inside of our transmitters as well. What I've been with people is I've been very realistic. What I don't want to do is I don't want someone to buy the radio knowing that they're going to have a problem with it and, you know, down the road. And I, you know, tell them pretty much point blank. I mean, some people will walk up to me at a show, especially people who are older, and they say, hey, is this easier to learn than Spectrum? And what they're really asking me is, I can't figure out Spectrum super well. Is this going to be easier for me? And the short answer is no. And, you know, the thing is that if you don't really understand a radio system, and Spectrum is not a very difficult one to figure out, then you'll have a lot of difficulties with FreeSky. However, if you're fairly comfortable with a radio system, then what you're going to find is that, and this is what I find across the board, is that there's a bit of a learning curve, and the way I describe it is this. It's a four-week process. Week number one is, this radio was cheap, and I bought it, and it looks kind of interesting, I'm going to go play with it. Week number two is, oh my God, I hate this effing thing. I would return it and get my money back, but this thing is evil, and I need to destroy it. And week number three is like, hold on a second, I'm starting to understand this now. Week number four is, I'm at the flying field telling all my friends to buy this radio because it's the best radio I've ever worked with my entire life. And that's the average guy right there, I would say. It is very easy to work with, but you kind of have to figure your way through the system. You cannot turn it on and figure it out by yourself, but there are so many videos we have out now, so much great information out there on how to work with these Ethos operating system that it is something that's very... it's now you can pretty much get your way through it. you don't have to be a rocket scientist. You just have to have a little bit of curiosity and a little bit of patience, and you're going to really enjoy the radio system. I've had more people, you know, and I hear from these people. They write me back and say, it's like my second week now, and I'm starting to figure my way out in this and that, and I've got my first model set up and ready to go out and fly, and it's fairly straightforward, and they have a pretty good experience with it. So, yeah, for the most part, it's a very – it's not self-evident where everything is like, it's – oh, my gosh, it's there. But once you start to figure it out, it doesn't take too long. When you start to realize that all the control surfaces, with each control surface, like aileron, elevators, everything you ever wanted to know about that in the mixer, all the information, the channel assignments, everything, the curves, dual rate, expo, all located in that one menu system. And once you get used to that, it's just like, wow, this is great. And if they can figure out, once you're in the mixer, there's a little plus button at the very top. If you push that button, then 20 other things pop up, and these are canned mixes. And these things are stellar, amazing stuff. I mean, I'm still playing and learning these things right now. And it's just the one thing I will say about the radio system, and I know this is where you and I differ. You are an immaculate pilot when it comes to tuning a plane. I mean, you understand the planes, your builds are perfect, and your radio setups are perfect. The models are perfect. This was something that, man, when I got started in RC, my planes could barely fly. And I think I sharpened my skills quite a bit because the planes were all over the place, and I'm always holding back elevator. I'm always doing this or that, or the other thing. Now my planes are, I can hand the radio over to somebody and say, here, fly this, because they pretty much fly themselves. They are just smooth as silk. And I think it's kind of half the fun. What I really enjoy about the radio system is that you can really fine-tune the radio. You don't need to go home. You don't need to open a manual. Once you understand it, it's like, oh, I want to do this. I wonder if I could do that. A good example of that, I have a plane that has a rear mid-fuselage pusher plane, so a large glider that has the prop behind the main wing. And I set it up so that I put a larger propeller on it, and because of that, the prop was above the thrust angle, which meant every time you put the throttle on, the nose dips down. And I'm sitting there flying this plane. I hadn't flown it in a while, and I'm flying it, and I go, man, I'm an idiot. I can fix this right now. And so I landed the plane. 30 seconds later, I had
like a throttle to elevator mix.
Yeah. I put that together, throttle elevator mix, set up the first time, no, it's going the wrong way, the other way, flip it around, and gave it a negative value, took it up there, and it was smooth as silk. I was just like, wow, watching the plane fly, this is perfect, you know, and these are things, I kind of see now that a lot of these planes are, I don't know, there's a lot of imperfections in planes, and you can actually kind of work them out through your radio if you can really refine a lot of the things.
Yeah, in my experience, I actually didn't find general programming to be particularly difficult. I think that doing anything like mixes, setting up rates, expos, the basic stuff was fairly simple. I think the part that was a bit harder to figure out is when you start to get to more complex setup with power distribution units plus multiple receivers, or when you're starting to get fancy with telemetry warnings that are kind of like very custom type actions. The first time you do it, you have to like figure out, like, look for what's the proper way to do it. To get that type of behavior, and then once you do it once, you know how to do it, and you don't have to think about it twice in the future.
Yeah. There's the other thing that I've noticed, and this one was something that I don't know how I got onto it, but I found this YouTube vlogger who all he does is review plane crashes, general aviation crashes, where people most of the time are fatalities. And so he started to answer the question that I had, which was, you know, they're on the news. You see somebody, well, he died. He was a pilot. He's 65 years old and had 5,000 hours of flying experience. I'm like, great. This guy was, and he's an instructor and this and that and the other thing. And great. Why is he dead? And so what it turns out to be was pretty much the same thing that I've seen time and time again, which is, it was the same answer all the time, which is, there's called the pilot workload. And the pilot workload means you have to do all sorts of different things. And when people say, like, I keep things all natural, I don't use Expo or this, that, or mixes or whatever else, they're putting all of that back on themselves. So what happens with these pilots who are out there flying is they're so busy doing stuff, and maybe they're talking to somebody in the, you know, that's with them as flying along with them, and they're talking to the control tower, and they're trying to keep all this in check, and they're not watching their gauges, and all of a sudden, something that they should have been paying attention to, all of a sudden becomes an emergency, and that's how they end up dying. And so, I've kind of noticed that too, and I just celebrated a birthday recently, and it's just another reminder that my 21st birthday was quite a long time ago. And the one thing I think that happens as you get older is just keeping track of all this stuff, you know, in real time becomes an issue. And it's just one of those things that realistically what we want to do is we want to be in the moment. We want to be enjoying flying and things like that. So to me, all these different mixes where it makes your life easier. I mean, it's really easy when you're sitting there and you're just getting up for the first time and you're trying to avoid trees or whatever the situation might be on your takeoff. And then all of a sudden you're like, man, I'm making all these really horrible turns because I'm not mixing in my rudder. And when you have a rudder to aileron mix already set up, or aileron to rudder mix already set up there, it just makes it easier. You don't have to remember it. It's already set up in your plane. If you wanted, you just set it up a little bit so that it's not so pronounced, and then you can add more in manually if you feel like it, but still you will have nice, fairly smooth turns if you turn that on.
So one of the things I've been looking at recently is the new firmware updates with Ethos. I know FreeSky is often iterating, pushing new updates, trying to improve the product. But I know that recently there was a pretty major firmware update, right? That was the 1.5 version of Ethos, and later that's been a major update. Can you talk about what's so significant about that update versus prior ones?
This one, it's the best way to describe this, why this was a major update, what happened was, a lot of people look at FreeSky and wonder, are we looking at Jetty? We're looking at Futaba? Are we looking at Spectrum? No, actually, what we're looking at is OpenTX, because that's what we spent years ago when we came out with that first X90 radio. We needed to have a radio firmware to work with, and what was on the market at the time was an open source project called OpenTX. A couple of years into the project, one of the main developers, we kept asking favors from, can you do this, can you do that? And the guy's like, listen, bud, I got a full-time job. I do this on nights and weekends. So we said, what if you didn't have a full-time job? What if you worked for us? And so he would like, I would like that very much. So for about 5 years, the OpenTX project, even though it was open source, was funded by FreeSky. And what happened was these radio systems were, they were very limited on the amount of hardware, the actual microprocessor, microcontrollers that were inside these radios, by today's standards, are very limited. However, the code was so well written that they were able to do a hell of a lot with this. And what happened by the time 2021 rolled around, the bar was set so high with this that when we were writing Ethos, we decided, well, I'll explain why we had to write Ethos in a moment here, but that was the bar that we looked at. This is where we should be at, is OpenTX. And the reason why is because we saw a lot of FreeSky pilots who, you know, were flying with OpenTX. Not a lot of them, but they would come up to us and say, you know, I really do miss things like the ability to look at my data logs. And I've missed the ability to look at, there is one thing that they just loved, which was the self trims. The idea that Insta-trim is what they called it. You're flying and you can hold the sticks in a certain position, push a button, let go, and your plane is trimmed. So you can just hold the plane level, push a button, let go, and the plane is now trimmed. At the end of the flight, you can go back and set it to sub-trims. It was amazing. And, you know, man, I just heard about that all the time. Anyone who ever flew Free Sky, I love that Insta-trim. Where's it at? Where's, you know. So to us, what the standard was to get up to this level. And there were a number of other things we needed to add in there as well. We had logical switches, but we didn't have global variables. So that was missing, and that was important to some people. And so all these different things, we also needed to update the transmitter ethos so that we can put in things like we needed to put in the stabilized receivers needed to have the best way to describe what happened with that was before Ethos, we only had 3 or 4 stabilized receivers. Now, after Ethos, we have probably 20 different stabilized receivers. Each one of those stabilized receivers is going to take time for us to write the code. And that is a project that's going to take approximately 3 to 4 more months from right now, where we have to write the code for each one of those stabilized receivers so that we could bake it into Ethos 1.5. So Ethos 1.5, in my opinion, should have been, this is the ethos that we should have had in the first place. This is what we should have come out with. What happened was we looked at the microcontrollers that we had. The microcontrollers that we have right now or prior to this were kind of hitting the limits is how far we can push them. And when we looked at Ethos, what we wanted to do was to offer, to get to the next level, we wanted to have the cell phone simplicity. We wanted to have it be more robust. This meant a larger microcontroller. That was the H7 microcontroller. And we decided to write for that microcontroller. Unfortunately, all the code base with OpenTX and everything else would not work. It would take a rewrite. And by that point, we kind of knew the limitations of OpenTX anyway. We knew where we made our mistakes. And we decided to start from ground zero. And that's what Ethos was. It was kind of like it has a more robust microcontroller. But it's also, we simplified things. We don't have an input, mixer, and output. It's just now mixer and output. It's one of the main things that's different about it. And there's just the ability to do things like logical switches now. You can actually name your logical switches, and you can also put nodes in there. Same thing with var, global variables, or we call vars. And you can also put in more lines of code. And I know most people don't really care to know how many lines of code goes in the mixer, except there are a few guys who fly gliders who want to put in over 100 lines of code in the mixer. And you can do that with Ethos, whereas OpenTX limited it to about 60, 64 lines of code before it was maxed out. So there's a lot more robustness about the Ethos 1.5. So Ethos 1.5 was a major hurdle to get over. And fortunately, you know, what we kind of got to was your radio had to be up to snuff. So the main things were the bootloader had to be up to date, and you need to have your internal module up to date. Those were the two big things. And occasionally what would happen is someone would try to install the Ethos 1.5 and their bootloader wasn't up to date. And because the bootloader wasn't up to date, it couldn't fire up the radio once again. All they got was a black screen and like, oh my God, I killed my transmitter. So that's where I think some of the, oh my gosh, this is horrible, this update's bad or whatever else. Not really. It's actually, once you go through the process, and we have videos out explaining how to do this, what you should be able to do is, once it's up to Ethos 1.5.4 now, it is fine. I mean, if people were crashing on Ethos 1.5.4, I would be hearing about it by now. And people are having, for the most part, a good experience. It's just the only issue they're having is getting to that level of getting the radios updated.
Yeah, basically you want to update everything, every part of the radio and your receivers. You don't want to have a mix of old firmware and the radio with a new receiver or something like that.
Yeah, and Ethos Suite fixes that now too. Like, once you get your internal module up to date, it will keep track of this from Ethos 1.5. It was like 1.51 it came out. It keeps track of your internal module, and it will let you know if you need to update your internal module. And that's something else. It's not quite in Ethos Suite, but it'll be really obvious your internal module's bad. Before, there was no indication of it. So, you know, it's going to get a lot easier.
Looking ahead, you know, we've talked about a lot of good things about FreeSky, but of course not perfect. Looking ahead, what do you envision the main areas for improvement that FreeSky has that you want to be looking at and hopefully improving in the next year, 2 years, 3 years?
One thing I would like to mention as we start talking about looking ahead was one thing that I've heard from people, which was the update cycle. Typically what happens is that when we get started with an update, the best way to describe it, for example, someone the other day mentioned to me, he said, why don't we have SBUS in beyond the last channel pin as well as the first channel pin? So I'm looking into that right now and figuring that out. If it's an update, it will be a firmware update that people will have. And I look at this and I say to myself, you know, for about 10% of the people, this is a huge deal. For 90% of the people, they don't care. They're not going to have a second receiver hooked up on pin one, and on a stabilized receiver, it's not going to be a big deal whatsoever. So what we're looking at, first and foremost, is an update cycle that kind of mimics the flying seasons for people. About 88% of the world's population lives in the Northern Hemisphere. And because of that, what happens is we all kind of go through winters and summers together. And this was something that, again, listening to people. So we have a guy who is, I don't know, he's just a guy who likes talking about FreeSky, and he's very knowledgeable. And about 5,000 people follow him. That's Richard Guy. And so when I talked to him, he was mentioning to me, he's like, well, you guys, please slow down on these updates. It's driving me nuts, you know, and people are getting a bit flustered with this. So I had a conversation with him, went home and thought about him, saw him again the next day and proposed this to him. And he said, yeah, this sounds great. And went back to, I talked to some other people and they said, yeah, this sounds great. Talked to my management about it and said, yeah, this is something we can do. And that is, we're going to have an update cycle that revolves around the flying season. So from February 1st to October 1st is your flying season, for the most part, in the Northern Hemisphere. And because it's a flying season, we're not really going to push out any updates unless it's something majorly significant or it fixes a critical bug. So what we're doing is taking a lot of these updates and we are going to push them off, these small incremental updates, and we're going to just make them available for people who might be having an issue with it. But we'll pick them up again in October through February. So that's going to be one major change I think a lot of people are going to look forward to. I think this is going to come down in the year 2025. It's a little late in the season, and plus we have this major Ethos 1.5 updates we're still working on. But yeah, I've told them, please slow it down. Now, as far as where the company is going, man, I wish I could buy stock. I wish this was a stock company, because I would absolutely buy stock in the company. We have a factory that's almost done in Thailand right now. It's essentially four times the size of what we have right now. So all our production, not some of it, but all of our production is going to move out of China. It's going to be moved to Thailand next year. We are planning to do some things in the market that are really, we're going to keep pushing ahead is the best way to describe it. We're going to be entering other markets. And I have a feeling that Free Sky, with where we're going as far as the other markets are concerned, it's going to be a well-funded operation. And that's exciting to me because what I would look forward to is hiring more engineers because I would like to have a dedicated full-time team of just engineers. All they do is work on fixed wing. And then we have another set of engineers who work on drones, another one that works on these other markets that we're going into as well. So I'm kind of envisioning that's where we're going to be going. A lot more engineers in the future. It's going to be a lot more exciting things. The other thing that we're looking to work on right now is fixing what we've got. And that has been a repeated thing that I've told management. At the end of Jonah last year, the president of the company asked me what would like, if there's anything I want to talk to him about before he goes. And I said, yeah, let's just fix what we have. We don't need to have 5,000 other things. So there are things that we're looking forward to fixing. I think the RB units are good. They could be a lot better. So those are one of the things that we're looking forward to fixing. And there are some things, you're starting to see it now with the radios, the X20S. It was a good radio, but we can make it even better. We have 900 megahertz only receivers that we haven't really touched in 5 years. And those are going to be updated this year as well. So there's a lot of things where we're going to look at it and really kind of focus, hone in on it and make them better. I think that the other thing that I'm really trying to work on right now is corporate communication, which I think is one of the weakest things about Free Sky is our ability to explain to people what's going on. And so we have someone right now who's, we're having them work on the first manual. This is somebody that I've known for a very long time. Very proficient, very good. She looked at the manuals we have right now and was absolutely amazed we put them out because they didn't make a lot of sense. So, yeah, they could be improved. Yeah, so I'm hoping that this person will move up in the organization to doing corporate communication because a perfect example of this was there was a critical bug fix for Ethos 1.54. You need to update to this immediately. And because there was an emergency mode issue. So I finally bit the other day and asked, okay, what's this emergency mode issue? We tell everyone they need to update to version 1.5.4. The reality is it was if you flew with a Zycor turbine and then you also had a Lewis script for something, these two things were fatal together and they would cause an emergency. It would essentially shut the radio down, which is great that they were able to fix it, but that is probably 0.1% of the whole market. And while everyone needed to, the other 99.9% needed to update their transmitters, it's not really that crucial.
I see.
So I would say in closing that the innovation, Free Sky is never going to stop making and improving. It's always the one thing. Oh, the other thing I really should mention is the servo line. Our servos right now, they're good. And we got you some servos to look at. It was the MD servos, right? You put that in your 60 size plane?
Yep, the 5301s.
Right, MD 5301s. So that one was the first of a new batch of cordless servos. And so the idea was the servo line is something that, for me personally, I think that is going to be the thing that we're going to keep improving on over the next 5 years. And because the reason why is because it's a good, really good market to be in. And our first attempt, we had some hits and some misses. And what I've noticed is that when they first rolled out, a lot of these servos got discontinued because we felt we could make them better or they just didn't sell very well. And I really do think that within the next couple of years, that the FreeSky servos are going to be something, a force to contend with. They're very good right now, but I don't know, that new MD servo is the first of many more servos like it, and the specs on it look like they're best in class. I know you're very picky when it comes to your servos, and this seemed to work fine for you, right?
Yeah, the MD5301s, that's what I'm still using on the 67-inch Pilot RC Extra. It's been working great, and I had Theta servos before that I really liked, so I had like a pretty good reference with the exact same airframe. So yeah, pretty happy with that. I'm definitely excited to see new future iterations of maybe the bigger servos.
The other thing I'll say about FreeSky is that the Ethos, what we're working on right now, this is going to be it for like the next 10 years. So it's going to keep growing and growing and growing and growing. It's going to be, because it's a new microcontroller and everything else, it is, right now I'm starting to see things get added to it. We're starting to see third-party vendors popping up, and you're going to see a lot more of this, a lot more people with Lua scripts coming out for that will do a lot more customization of the radios. They're going to work with a lot of other brands. We always look forward to working with other brands as well. So you'll see a lot more of that in the future. You're going to see that it's going to be, because it is so robust, that a lot of really neat things are going to pop up for the FreeSky transmitter. The one thing I would really love to see, and something I'll push for, is something I've seen this quite a bit in other things where they have the basic mode and the advanced mode for the Ethos, for everything. So I'd like to see Ethos have a basic mode set up in it where it gets rid of everything you don't want. And I've seen this in other operating systems. What they do is they have tiles you can turn off. If you don't have any interest in global variables or logic switches, just turn those things off.
Yeah, trying to make it user friendly for beginners or for people that don't care about this extra functionality, but still letting more advanced users do whatever they need to do.
Right, and then the ability to move the tiles around so you can kind of put them where you want them to be. Hopefully someday it'll be in color, things like that. But the idea is that we're looking for it to be something where you have a lot more flexibility. It's going to be a whole operating system. Essentially, it's the best way to describe it is Ethos is like a cell phone, and we're going to have a lot more apps coming out for the future, third-party apps showing up for this. We're starting to see them right now. More are on the way.
Cool. Looking forward to checking that out.
Cool. Yeah.
Well, I don't want to take more of your time. I think we've already been here for like almost an hour and a half, but I think there's a lot of good info for either existing FreeSky users or for people that are considering looking into it or making the jump. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, thanks for having me, Juan. Really appreciate it.
And I'll make sure to put some links to learn more about FreeSky on the description. I know that the Facebook official FreeSky group is like super, super useful for either new or existing users to get more information about what FreeSky is working on, or if people have questions about how to do certain thing, right? Or what will be the best setup for their planes. And I think you are pretty active there too, right?
Yes. And then the other thing I would say is, if you can make it to Jonal this year, this is the best year to come to Jonal. Not only will I be there, and FreeSky Ben and the rest of the FreeSky gang, but we are going to hopefully have the new Tandem X20 RS transmitter there as well. And we have a very special team pilot that's going to be there doing noontime shows for us. So we're looking forward to seeing you, Juan.
Yeah, I'm kind of with Fred. This will be super fun.
It's going to be a great time.
Well, thanks again, Steve.
All right, thanks.
Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.